process has also been to give you an introductory series on basic Christianity, and to that end, an introductory series on Genesis 1 to 3. Partly because people think that that would be as hard a part to strike, and if we can explain Genesis 1 to 3, well then the rest of the Bible is going to be simple. Partly because Genesis 1 to 3 actually sets out the basis of the Christian understanding of the world. The final talk is on death in Genesis 3, because Genesis 2 promised that the day in which we eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, we will die. And at the beginning of chapter 3, that is what they do. They eat of that fruit, and so are driven out of the garden at the end of the chapter, chapter 3, and away from the tree of life. And so we see the rest of the Bible, which is 65 books minus 3 chapters, the rest of the Bible is living outside of the Garden of Eden, living under death. Because of the ambiguity of life today, the world is a confusing place. It's such a strange mixture of good, bad, ugly, of the desirable and the undesirable. You see, we humans are clever enough to be able to create the arms race and the drug trade. No other animal in the world is clever enough to do that. We love truth, but we all tell lies. Professor Gerald Jellison of the University of Southern California earlier this year caused a slight media stir in an academic journal by reporting his study of people in Southern California telling lies. And he showed that having wired people up and recording everything they'd said for a day and so on, he was able to record that people, on average, tell 200 lies a day. That is, on average, we tell a lie every 8 minutes. It's not bad, is it? Not many things we can do that frequently. We love to tell the truth, but in fact, we're inveterate liars. We love honesty. The British psychologist Richard Wiseman of the Hertfordshire University sent a series of checks to people, mistaken checks. 60% of them were cashed rather than returned. We love honesty, but in fact, that's not what we're like. And it's not only us in our ambiguity. The world itself is an ambiguous place. The magnificence of the mountains and the valleys go hand in hand with the earthquakes and the volcanoes. We have viruses, which are a wonderful life form, some of which spell death for anybody who gets them. We have children, a couple of children born in the church I'm a member of, born with cancer. There's something profoundly wrong with the world where little children are born with cancer, isn't there? The undesirable things of this life are so sturdy, flies, cockroaches, maggots, while the desirable things like koalas are so fragile. Weeds, the unwanted plants, are so robust, flowers and vegetables are so vulnerable. You look at the world and you've got to ask, well, has God made a mistake? I mean, maybe there's not a God. Maybe there's two gods, good God and a bad God. Maybe God's just quixotic, changing his mind all the time. Maybe he's gone on a long holiday. Maybe he's lost control. There are so many good things that you'd want to say, look, there is the hand of God, and there are so many bad things that you'd want to say, well, if that's God, I don't want to see the rest of his hand. It's all mixed up. Now, the Bible's answer is our eviction from the Garden of Eden. Our eviction from the garden party, because it starts in chapter 2 with everything being good. Beauty, food, drink, work, the relationship of male and female united together so that they can be in perfect harmony, naked and unashamed with each other, living God's way, God determining how the garden is to be gardened, determining what is good and what is bad. But then it all goes bad. It goes bad when they eat of the tree of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, because then they try to replace God. They try to live and to garden their own way, not God's way. They try to be the determiners of what is good and what is evil. And so we have today's ugly scene in chapter 3 of death, the curse of God, the very judgment of God. But God's judgment is just, even if it is ugly. He warned them that if they did this, then they would die. They did it, they disobeyed, and so they die. Yet for those who are ignorant of the Bible, simplistic and prejudiced against Christianity, because they too have eaten of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, it always sounds unjust. You eat one apple and you go to hell for eternity. I mean, you don't do that with the local boys who nick an apple from an orchard. You might spank them, you might, in a previous generation, of course, you might speak harshly to their parents, and in the present generation, you might do all, but you wouldn't send them to prison, you wouldn't send them to death, you wouldn't send them to death forever for one apple. And so God seems profoundly unjust, if not ludicrous, that he sends people to hell because Adam ate an apple. But that is just a sheer prejudice of ignorance, and ignorance that has come out of prejudice. For that is not what the passage is about at all. It's not an apple. Apple's never mentioned, of course. It's a fruit which symbolises the reality. The reality that is ours of rejecting God as God. Of establishing ourselves as God. It's the unilateral declaration of independence. That is what Adam and Eve are about when they eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Because it is God's prerogative and only God's prerogative to determine what is good and evil. Man can rule the world, but he must do it God's way. The one symbol of not doing it God's way, but doing our own way, is that fruit, why it has such a strange name. And therefore the punishment of God justly fits the crime. We want to live with life without God. We want him to butt out, to back off, to not tell us what to do, for us to decide what we are going to do with our life. And so, that's what happens. God backs off. God butts out. God gives us up to the very thing we asked for. We asked to live without him, and so we live without him. We asked to be the people who make up the rules, and so he says, okay, there's the world, you run it. Your way. And that is why it is the disaster that it's in. You see, you can teach a child restraint by saying, don't keep eating those lollies, you'll get sick. Take the lollies away from them. Or you can teach a child by experience. You're going to be sick if you keep eating, so here, keep eating, you'll find out soon enough, they'll all come back. And you will know. That is the child's way of pigging out on lollies is a futile, foolish way that doesn't work, that is totally counterproductive. God could have stopped us then and there in the garden, but rather he gives us our head to discover the disaster we create. But it's not just utilitarian, it's not just so as to teach us. It is also because it's just. God is giving us what we ask for. The punishment fits the crime. He's not giving us anything more than we ask for. We asked for it. And so the garden becomes the scene of the curse of God, characterized by alienation and by domination, by absence and by rationalizations. The four headings that are there under point number 3, slightly changed. Alienation is the first one, and it's spelled out in chapters 3 and 4 fairly clearly. We're alienated from God. Chapter 3, verse 8, Adam tries to hide. Adam and Eve try and hide from God. And when confronted in verse 10, they say, it's because we're afraid. And so they are banished out of God's garden, out of his presence. And in chapter 4, the story of Cain and Abel, the brother who kills the brother, it all gets even further. Cain is angry with God and he lies to God and he is cursed even more by God. That is, the friendly, easy access to God is broken. People today can feel remote and distant from an angry and righteous God who judges the universe. The very mention of God as an angry God, God as a God of judgment, makes people feel guilty. I never ever have people ask me not to talk about God being the God of love, but I rarely ever can mention hell without people trying to stop me. Always want me not to speak about it. It's a nasty thing to do to people. To make them afraid. It's using fear tactics down at Botany Bay. our local council has been dreadfully immoral, because it's put these huge signs up, written in several languages, but with a big picture of this mean, dreadful-looking shark, and a sign saying, "Don't swim, danger, sharks." At least that's what it says in English, so I presume it says it in the other languages as well. Now, that's dreadful, isn't it? I mean, that's using scare tactics, isn't it? That's making people feel fearful and afraid. There they are in their swimming togs and they're going down into the water for the last swim of their life, and you've made them feel all nervous and agitated. Now, that's not nice, is it? That's really unpleasant to warn people of things in a way that might make them scared. You see the stupidity of the logic, but we do not want to hear about a God who would warn us of punishment to come. It is immoral to use fear, as immoral as the local council at Botany Bay. My friends, people do not want to hear today about God. It's a subject that is taboo in many circles. As one who tries to raise it from time to time, I can assure you it is taboo in the life of many people. God is a long way away from where we want to be. We withdraw, hide, and avoid the discussion. You can see it when you discuss lives, when you discuss death, hell, judgment. Now, try it out just with death. Next time you go to a dinner party, turn to your hostess or host and say, "Why don't we spend a few minutes talking about your death?" Death is a good subject to talk about, isn't it? It's fairly standard activity. Most people go for it. We're all going to face it sooner or later. Your shares and stocks may go up, may go down. You may never have them. But you're going to die, so why don't we talk about the reality, death? You don't get many invitations to dinner parties if you have this approach to social life. It's not a subject people want to talk about. It's not a subject that's really on our curriculum. It's interesting, of course, and a famous thing within the hospital world to see how everybody vacates the room where people are dying. Not out of any concern for them, but out of our own impotence in the face of the reality of life, which is death. We're alienated with God, alienated from our creation too. The snake is cursed and the woman's child is going to crush it. The woman has pain in her childbirth. Man now works with sweat and painful toil. Even for Cain in the next chapter, it even becomes harder. That is, the world, which has such potential for prosperity, is alien to our endeavours. Around the world, the deserts increase, the soil degrades, the weeds multiply, and diseases are propagated. We are not in an ecologically level playing field. Ecological balance is a myth. As if somehow, if we weren't here, everything would be just balanced and working perfectly. It's not like that. The world is hostile to humanity, just as sinful humans are often hostile to the world. We are part of the ecological mess, but it's a mess. It's not a balance. And we're making it worse. And we're alienated from each other. Verse 7, you see how they see that they're naked and they cover themselves because they can't now live naked. See, as long as I am living God's way and you are living God's way, you and I can be completely unashamed and unafraid of each other. But once we've got rid of God and I am now making up the rules, well, I can do to you anything I want to do. And as I look at you and think about it, I think to myself, yes, and you can do to me anything you want to do. And as I think of the things that I could do to you and would do to you and might like to try to do to you, I start to realise they're the same things you're thinking about me. I can't live naked and unashamed in front of you now. I need protection. I need to be covered. And so we're alienated from each other. The next chapter, one brother murders another, and then there's fear of strangers, and you wind up at the end of just the next chapter with a man called Lamech who practices polygamy, which of course is a terrible degradation of women, who murders and who practices revenge and even boasts about it. That is, we live in a world where women all over the world and all down the centuries have been oppressed by the brutality of males We live in fearful unhappiness in the area of our greatest joy, namely our families, as one third of our marriages end in divorce. We live in the place where brothers fight with each other in hostility. We live in a world where the person that is most likely to kill you is the person living in your own home. And finally, we're alienated from life itself. Chapter 3, verse 22, they're driven from the tree, the source of life. And so mortality, which is so foreign to us, becomes statistically normal for us. We all die. And yet he who desires death is demented, is mad. We put them in psychiatric care. We spend our lives fighting to live and rejecting the truth of our own mortality and screening out any indication of it. I am one of the oldest of that group that are called the baby boomers, for I was born just after the Second World War. The baby boomers who think they're middle-aged, but they're actually all past it now. Middle-aged is 5 years older than whatever age I am at the moment. It's a kind of sliding scale. I'm not middle-aged, I'm an old man. But yet we still think that we are middle-aged. We will not face the reality that we're old. We're desperately kind of holding it in and holding it on as much as possible that we can and keeping it up wherever possible. Both three of them, they're all kept up because we will not face the reality of our own impending mortality. We can't cope with it. The domain of death, the domain of mortality where steadily marches the maggot of our existence, the domain outside the garden is too much for us. And so we screen out information and any indication. We will not accept the news. And now we live in this domain. We live under a domination of deceit and darkness and decay. Deceit because the devil is the father of all lies, and outside of the garden, the whole world is under control of the evil one, the God of this age, as the Bible calls him. And so we exchange the truth of God for a lie. We no longer see God as the ruler of our lives. We are the rulers of our own lives. We saw it just in those interviews of just a few minutes ago. That God keeps on being put aside. There's a world force that is running my life, and so I am responsible for my own decisions. Who's running her life? She is running her life. She is her own God. Her own goddess. I don't mean to pick on her particular. No, no, from any more than the screen. She is just one of what people are like. It is how people think. We've exchanged the truth of God to live the life of the lie. And building the world on lies, you get these sad video clips day after day where there is no truth. Everybody's truth is true for them. The Forbes Smith building in which we're in down the way there has a sign over the front door, doesn't it? Great is truth and mighty above all things. That philosophy has totally gone, judging by the video clips we've had this week. When asked about the truth of God, more than half the people, as I counted them up, didn't talk about God, they talked about truth, and the thing they all said about truth is, be true to yourself. Your truth is as important as anybody else's truth. Truth is where you find it. Truth is your saying. It's all just sheer subjectivity. Harold Bloom wrote it up, the American Jewish scholar, in that book he entitled The Closing of the American Mind, the terrible relativistic nonsense that is going on in this world. To talk about my opinion and your opinion being of equal value is one thing, but to talk about my truth and your truth is to say there is no truth. That is a very, very different worldview. That is a nightmare Franz Kafka worldview. And it's no surprising then that the politicians tell us that they can't rule the world without lies. And the psychologist, even the one I quoted earlier, tells us that you can't live without lies. In fact, it's the way to live. It's a good thing. You see, I haven't seen the film yet, but there's a current film about, isn't there, Liar, Liar, about the reformed compulsive lawyer, Liar, who now has to tell the truth, and I presume the humorous difficulties he gets himself into it. See, lying promises me freedom. It promises me freedom to create the world that I want to create. It promises me freedom from truth. Freedom from unpleasantness, freedom from confrontation with other people and with reality. In fact, it promises me freedom from reality. Lies are the best drug going. They don't damage your health and promise you total freedom for a world of your own making. But lies, like any drug, provide bondage.
He provides the world run by the liars that we have as politicians, real estate agents, used car salesmen, the lies of the advertisers with their terrible corruption of the cigarettes, the lies of the legal profession as they postpone the cases of asbestosis until the people die so that they can't actually pay out for the penalty, the terrible deaths that they have labelled upon people through asbestos. It creates the lack of trust. And without trust, there can be no society, there can be no community, there can be no friendship, there can be no family. It creates the mess that we are in. The terrible web we weave when we deceive. That's the world we live in, a world of lies. That ultimate lie, there is no truth. It was in the Bible, of course. It's on the lips of Pontius Pilate when he condemns Jesus to death. Truth? What's truth, he says. And condemns the man to death. It, of course, is the ideal of Nietzsche, the great atheist, who became the intellectual and philosophically important mind for Mussolini after he was given the book by Adolf Hitler. Deceit, that's the world we live in. And darkness. The dominion is not only deceit but darkness. And one of the great deceits is the 18th century movement called the Enlightenment. They moved away from God and put man in the place of God and created the modern Western civilization as we know it and called themselves the Enlightenment. But Jesus said it the other way around. Jesus said people prefer darkness because their deeds are evil. It's still true, isn't it? If you want to protect your buildings, you put lights around the buildings. And aren't there more and more houses now where you walk up the driveway and suddenly the lights come on? Isn't it wonderful, the society we live in? You can't trust anybody who comes to your house now. Because we live in a world of deceit, we live in a world of darkness, and people prefer darkness. But Rousseau, he's one of the great Enlightenment figures who lived to the 18th century, a romantic Enlightenment, but romantic. He's the father of modern education and much political philosophy as well. And he believed, you see, that all people were good. That was the great vision he had on the road. Everybody, everywhere is fundamentally, profoundly, by nature, good. The only thing that's bad is the system, is the civilization, is the organization. Free people from the systems, allow them to just be themselves, and if they were just themselves, then they would learn, they would inquire, they would grow in knowledge, they would do good moral things. Here is Mr. Rousseau. Of course, when you find out what Mr. Rousseau was like in his own natural instincts, it does change the view. Paul Johnson did a great service to humanity in producing a book called The Intellectuals about 10 years or so ago now. There's a chapter on Rousseau there. That's the easiest place I know to get hold of the story. For Rousseau spent his life bludging off other people, living in hostility and hatred. He was an inveterate hater of people. He used women, and one woman he used to have 5 children, whom he took away from her and dumped into an orphanage, where the children were known by Rousseau to die within 2 years, which may explain why he didn't bother giving them names. Here is the father of modern education. Here is the Enlightenment man who is living out of the rationality of his own goodness. Darkness, we hide the horror of our own evil hearts. The dumped children, the aborted females. Several of the comments cards have mentioned to me that they thought I was wrong about that, and I may well be wrong about it. Up here in Queensland, of course, away from home, I haven't got my library. All I found was this short newspaper clipping in my folder, which comes from the London Telegraph on April this year. It also was in the Sydney Morning Herald on the 12th of April, where it points out that the official figures show that the sex ratio of China's population is now 131 males to every 100 females. That in one province, whose name I cannot pronounce, there's one province, there are 860 unmarried males aged 22 and only 360 unmarried females at the age 22. The problem was caused, it says, by abortion of female fetuses and the abandoning and murder of baby girls. It records one magazine which says, they cites the case of a father in northeastern China who smothered his 2 happy and healthy daughters in the hope he could start a family again with a son. It also points out that ultrasounds, that wonderful technology which shows how clever we are, ultrasound scans have made it easier for parents to detect unwanted girls in the womb, and they are the secret weapons. giving birth to males. Now, I may be wrong, but that's where I'm getting information from, and I'm getting it consistently from many sources. It's the same story. And it doesn't surprise me, because it is the character of the darkness of this world. Romania and its dumped children, India has got the same kind of pattern, and the Australian track record on abortion on demand is really horrific. The moral arguments that were used in the 60s bear almost no relationship to the practices of the 90s. And death is only the final state of decay, and decay is all around about us as we age and as we feel the rattles and groans of the car about to collapse, the warning trumpets of our grave coming. You can be all for pain relief in childbirth, I am. You can be all for improved marriage counselling, I'm for that. You can be all for better agricultural methods to get rid of weeds, I'm for that too. But you've got to recognise that we've been all for these things for ever since Adam was a boy. And we still have the problems, and we will always have the problems, because the world we live in is a decadent world. We live outside the Garden of Eden. Yet in all this alienation and domination and negative side of the picture, we're not totally outside of God's presence. We've been put out of the garden, we've been given up by God to do our own thing, and we're doing our darndest to wreck the place. But yet, he still continues with us. You see it there in the chapter. He clothes the man and the woman. He recognises, yes, you now need to live with clothes, but he provides the clothes better than the clothes they had provided. He promises in verse 15 that the serpent will be crushed by the son of the woman. He goes on to protect Cain in the next chapter. It is why our world is ambiguous. It's why our world is not hell. There's yet to come something worse. Because God, though absent, is still present. You see, we still have beauty. We still have food. We still have drink. We still have life. It's just we also now have horror and famine and drought and death. Because God is absent. He's given us up to do it ourselves, yet not totally given us up. He still had his solution that he was to bring. But before I mention his solution, let me just point out the other problem we have outside the garden. That is our own foolish rationalizations, our own foolish false explanation. The naturalists, as old as Rousseau, who think nature is good and only civilization is evil, if we could just get back to nature, everything that is natural, sugar sales skyrocketed. I shouldn't mention this in Queensland. Sugar sales skyrocketed when the advertisers came up with that wonderful thing, the natural way of life. I suppose you were in late primary school, early high school, most of you, when it came on. Sugar prices, sugar was just dropping. People were giving up sugar. That was all unnatural. And then they just, for about 2 years, said, sugar, the natural way to live. Sugar went up. Sugar sales skyrocketed. Whether it's good for us, whether it's bad for us, is an irrelevance. It's natural. That's all that counts. And so, why do we live a natural life? We drop out and go to Nimbin and live like noble savages. A myth that was well exposed in the critique of by the novel by William Golding, The Lord of the Flies, where little English boys go back to nature and are true to themselves. Or you can be the technologist, rearrange the world, fix it, guys. You know, the economists, the politicians, the lawyers, the engineers. There's a problem, we're going to fix it. I've come across recently the writings of John Ralston Saul, who talks about the corporatist rationalism of the modern world and the disaster that it is creating. I encourage you to read a Canadian humanist, historian, businessman, author now, that talks about the problem of corporatism, the problem of the business administration degrees that think by administration we're going to fix everything, when in fact they never know what they're trying to fix. They have no scheme for where it's going to. Some years ago, the social work faculties used to teach their students that they were change agents, but they could never decide in which direction they were changing things, where they were going, because that would have been judgmental. You've got to be a change agent who works for your client, so your client determines what changes they want, and you help them to put those changes into effect, but you mustn't judge them. It's self-determination, Dave. And so you go and work for the fascist party and help them to change society as they want to. It's just as good as working for the communist party or working for single mothers or working for white Anglo-Saxon Protestant males. It doesn't matter who you work for, you are the change agent. See, that's the mechanic. That's the rationalist. There is no ultimate good. There is just mechanisms to get things done. But never ask us what things or why. Occasionally you come across the real atheist whose solution is simple. There's nothing wrong with the world. This is just the way it is. It's all a big accident, and here we are. We used to be in the swamp as microbes, and now we're running around Brisbane as humans. It's six of one, half a dozen of the other. The microbes generally aren't worried about things. But then again, we can talk about our worries. So we're better than them and not better than them, and it doesn't matter. We're all going to die. We're all crematorium material. Enjoy what you're enjoying, unless you're a masochist, and then suffer what you're suffering. Whatever you like. It doesn't matter. That meaningless activity is rare to find in its honesty and integrity. Death is not a simple, but it's a very difficult problem. Its cause is deep in the heart of our existence, and its extent covers the whole of our disordered world now as well as our end, because it is God's just punishment for rebellious people. But God has his solution. It was Adam who brought us all into this domain, and yet we all make the same choice as he did to oppose God and to eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We all want to run our own lives our own ways, our own families, our own societies our own ways. So God sent another Adam, another man, the man Jesus, who brings the new humanity. He didn't rebel against God. He didn't choose to live his own way. He was God's own son, but he always accepted God's way of doing things. When he came to the garden, it was a different garden, a garden called Gethsemane, just outside of Jerusalem. And it was the night before his death, and he had a choice as Adam had a choice. He had the choice to live his own way and avoid death and let mankind die, or he could live his way, he could live his life God's way, his Father's way, and accept death and save mankind. He didn't want death because he knew what death meant. He knew it meant the alienation from God and from this world and from other people. He knew its darkness. He knew its horror. He didn't want death. He hated the idea of death. He prayed, if there's a possibility, take this cup away from me. But he also prayed, not my will, but your will be done. I don't want to live my life my way, but my life your way. Fundamentally different to Adam. It meant that this Adam, Jesus, didn't have to die because he didn't eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He didn't make up what he should do. He accepted what God said to do. But he did die. And he died with the words of the psalm on his lips, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's not asking a question, he's quoting a psalm. Read the whole psalm, you'll see what it's about. It's about his crucifixion, prophesied almost 1,000 years before it happened. He's declaring that he is God forsaken, because that's what death is, to be given up by God, to be abandoned by God. He who had lived in perfect unity with God in all eternity was ripped apart from God. He died, but he didn't die his own death. He died your death, he died my death, he died for us. And in his death he was alienated from God. He was forsaken by God. In his death he was alienated from creation and from life, from his friends who all deserted him, from his own people who crucified him. He was brought under that domain of deceit and darkness and decay that we have touched and lived in. But he was finally given up by God into the hell of God's punishment. Yet being God's son, being the righteous one, death could not hold him, but he rose again to new life and appeared to people, the evidences of which you can find in any of the history books you care to pursue. He appeared to people because he rose up, he restored relationship with God, for he had paid the penalty for us and brought the new creation and changed relationships between people. Yesterday I gave you this kind of picture, that the first Adam, through his disobedience, brought death for many people in condemnation, just as the last Adam, Jesus, through his obedience to death, brought life for many people and salvation. Jesus is God's solution to our rebelliousness against him. And that is why Christianity is not about being good, it's not about being moral, it's not about keeping 10 commandments. Christianity is about Christ, about him paying the penalty for us. That is why he is the only way to heaven, because only he is good enough to pay the penalty for us. Other people can come and teach us all kinds of wisdom and truth, but no one else can die in our behalf than this one. And so if you'll turn with me to the prayer on the back of the outline, you'll see how you become a Christian is by accepting this last Adam. It's an acknowledgement that you are guilty of running your own life your own way in the first paragraph, and it's thanking God for his solution, sending his son to die for me that I may be forgiven and rising to give me new life. And so it asks for exactly that. Forgiveness, which is what we need, and transformation. And the fundamental heart of the transformation is not that I'll be good or better or something like that, but that I'll live in a relationship with Jesus as my ruler. From rebel to the citizen of the kingdom of God. Let's pray. If you know that you're ready to be praying this prayer, then join me in the quietness of your own mind as I pray to God aloud and lead you. Dear God, I know I'm not worthy to be accepted by you. I don't deserve your gift of eternal life. I am guilty of rebelling against you and ignoring you, and I need forgiveness. Thank you for sending your son to die for me that I may be forgiven. Thank you that he rose from the dead to give me new life. Please forgive me and change me that I may live with Jesus as my ruler. Amen. Friends, as we just take a moment to fill out this card, let me tell you that those of you who pray that prayer today, this week, next week, tonight at home, those who pray a prayer like that, the words are not magic, it doesn't matter whether you use those exact words or not, but those who pray in that fashion to God, you will be forgiven and you will be changed. Please take a note take a moment to write some comments or your name on this card, especially remembering the people around about you that you're just helping them by doing it. But if you're someone who is praying and would like to become a Christian, then tick that top box that's there. If you want to find out more, because there are many people who say, look, it's wonderful to be proposed that our whole life should be given away, but I just haven't had time to think about it yet. This is the first Christian meeting I've been to in 10 years. I don't really know. Then, by all means, find out more, but take action. Don't just take another 10 years before you turn up to another meeting. Start finding out now, because if this is true, this is the very meaning of life and death and eternity. If it's false, you need to get rid of it so that you don't have to turn up in 10 years' time and hassled by the idea of guilt that maybe you're doing the wrong thing. So do find out.